Well, I think we're ready now to kick off the session. Today's featured speakers are Danny Reibel, Victor Magar, and Leah Evanson. Annie is currently with the University of Texas at Austin, and before that spent over 23 years at Louisiana State University. Victor Magar is with Environ, and he has over 15 experiences dealing with sediment management issues. And then finally, Leah Evanson, who's with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation Innovation Office, will be co-presenting with Victor on monitoring sessions. Leah has spent over 15 years with the agency, in the center of executive and technical advisory. Again, for those of you on the phone, if you could do place us on mute, that would be greatly appreciated. And with that, if you'd like to know more about their information, I'd encourage you to go to their bio sketches, which are online. So before I turn it over to Danny, to kick off this seminar, again, I want to remind people, as you can see here in the background, to hit *6 now or hit your mute button. Again, do not put us on hold. Go ahead, Danny.
Thank you, Kelly. Well, my goal today is to kind of introduce the topic, and I think I have a couple of specific goals for my short presentation at the start. One is to make sure that everybody recognizes that we can't hope to, in just a couple of hours, cover everything that might be happening at individual sites. There is a great deal of site specificity with contaminated sediments and a variety of processes that may be important at one site or another. And we're going to touch on some of the key guiding issues, but I'm also going to illustrate some of the problems that are almost very specific to individual contaminants, individual sites. It's just critical in contaminated sediment arena, especially when trying to evaluate natural attenuation processes, to fully understand the site, to develop a comprehensive conceptual site model and understand what are the processes that influence the exposure and risk associated with your contaminants at that site, and ultimately how either natural processes or other processes might intervene to manage those that exposure and risk. I'm going to turn to slide 2, and where I've illustrated some of the processes that are important at the sediment-water interface that can lead to attenuation of the exposure and risk to the site. There's a variety of processes both in the water side as well as on the sediment side, and some of them are illustrated here. Over the past 20 or so years, I and colleagues have tried to examine each of these and tried to develop some tools and models that help us evaluate them at particular sites. But to greater or lesser degrees, they're all present at sites, and they may or, again, one or more of them might be the most important. And if we turn to slide 3, kind of an illustration of some of that. Just an effort on this and the next slide to talk about the various conditions you might see at different sites, trying to break it into lake like sites, river sites, and as we'll see in a moment, estuarine and coastal marine sites. They all have very different behaviors and assumptions that you might make about one type of site or one particular condition shouldn't be assumed to apply at others. Certainly, if the mental model that you have in your mind is running by you, for example, after living in 23 years in Louisiana, that's often my first thought. But that's certainly a very different physical situation and a very different physical environment for contaminants and the processes that might lead to exposure and risk than, say, a coastal marine environment. And it's important to keep that in mind. Listed on this table on slide 3 are a variety of rough characteristics that might generally be true in this case, lake-like environments and river-like environments. But it's, again, it's not true of all sites, but it's, again, is often true of a lake-like site. It tends to be a lower-energy environment, but even there, near shore, you could have processes such as wind-driven waves. It could be a very different situation than you might have over much of the lake. Well away from shore, also, you might have very little groundwater upwelling at times, whereas near shore you might have more significant upwelling, and in river sites you might have more significant upwelling. So again, the conditions are quite different at the Slide 4 shows the same sort of table, a generic list of processes that might be the most important at a typical estuarine and coastal marine site. Slide 5 is a first attempt to try to quantify that, to illustrate the magnitude of some of the processes that we saw on slide 2. In slide 5, what I've done is looking at kind of a typical hydrophobic organic, something like, say, pyrene, with a sediment that might have 1% organic carbon. What would be the range or the estimated value of the time that it would require for diffusion, for example, to significantly impact concentrations in a, and unfortunately I see a typo, what we have is a 10 centimeter thick surface layer, not a 10 meter thick surface layer. And how long would it take by these particular processes, if operating at either normal rates or the rates that are specified, how long would it take before they would significantly reduce the concentration of the contaminants in that 10 centimeter layer? And diffusion can be extremely long. We're looking at well over 1,000 years before we see significant diffusive influence on that surface layer. Whereas advection could be somewhat faster at a groundwater upwelling velocity, but of course it depends on what that velocity is. And in this case, I've chosen a velocity order of a meter a year. At the order of a centimeter a year, for this degree of hydrophobicity, it's probably not much different from diffusion, mathematically. For sediment erosion, if we choose a rate, in this case, I've just arbitrarily chosen a rate of erosion of a centimeter a year, of course, it can be quite fast. But interestingly, even in the absence of erosion, bioturbation, the normal mixing activities of organisms that live at the sediment-water interface, can also be quite rapid at typical rates. So we can see that these two processes, sediment erosion and bioturbation, are, at least in this particular scenario, the most significant. That is, the fastest process, the one that would lead to the fastest fluxes to the overlying water. But in addition, that's true in many, many locations. And in many locations as well, where we're interested in a fairly stable sediment environment, it may very well be that bioturbation is the most important and most significant factor leading to both direct exposure of organisms as well as flux to the overlying water. If we turn to slide 6, that point is emphasized even more, where that is, if we look at the direct flux to the overlying water, we're typically looking at either erosion or resuspension, or in places where that's not as important, or even in places where it might be important, bioturbation could still be of roughly equal rate and magnitude. But we're also, if we're looking at exposure and risk, we're often concerned about accumulation in the benthic community itself. And then, of course, where these organisms live in that surface layer is directly a point of exposure. So if we have, as routes of exposure and risk, either direct flux overlying water or accumulation in the benthic community and potentially leading to food chain transfer, both of those are heavily influenced by the organisms themselves. And it also gives an indication that the zone that we're interested in, at least at any given time, is the zone where these organisms exist. That's the zone that's being mixed, and that's the zone where the accumulation of contaminants can occur. If we turn to slide 7, I'm going to examine bioturbation just a little bit more, just to illustrate its significance at sites where sediments are relatively stable. We typically are looking at depths of 5 to 15 centimeters. We're looking at reworking rates that are of the order of centimeters per year for the sediment particles themselves, sometimes much faster than that in the water, the pore water that the organisms are moving around. But even at a centimeter a year, we're moving sediment particles for organisms as they process that sediment, especially deposit feeders that are feeding on that sediment. They're reworking of the order of a centimeter a year, which, in terms of the order of magnitude, we're looking at how fast the 5 centimeters are impacted. It's of the order of 5 years. So this process can be very, very fast, and especially in some contaminated sites, so just as an example, in a freshwater contaminated site, you might see very high densities of some of these organisms that are doing this processing. Tuba fifth validity for fairly hardy individuals that can live in contaminated sites, and in some of contaminated sites, in particular Indiana Harbor, found densities of up to 1 million per square meter of these organisms. On slide 8, there's a picture of what we see in a cartoon of the way that we would picture the sediment-water interface if bioturbation is the primary force for moving sediments and moving contaminants associated with those sediments to the near surface. What we see is organisms processing that upper surface, effectively churning that upper surface sediment, and then moving material to the surface where it can then be released by dissolution into the overlying water, even if the organisms don't directly inject sediment particles to the overlying water, which in some organisms can do that as well. In slide 9, we start to turn to recognize that even though in a stable sediment environment, which many of us are often concerned about, even though bioturbation may be the dominant feature, there's a variety of other features and factors that must be taken into account if we're going to assess monitored natural recovery. And I've just chosen 4 to illustrate that, and we'll look at each of them in turn. On slide 10, I'm illustrating that there is often, even though the bulk sediment concentration would be at a certain level, the amount that might be available to organisms could be somewhat less as a result of desorption resistance. And what I'm showing on slide 10 is illustration that a certain, we often see a certain fraction of contaminants that come off very slowly and to a limited extent, a certain fraction of contaminants that come off relatively rapidly and almost completely. The net effect is that broken line where we see essentially an asymptote where a certain fraction of the contaminants don't appear to be released, and often that means that it doesn't appear to be available to organisms. And that's illustrated in slide 11, where some work that we've done in our own lab looking at these tubicicida lidkeets that are feeding on the sediment. So the route of uptake is by ingestion, but we're still looking at accumulation, which is what's shown here, normalized accumulation that is actually well predicted by pore water concentration. That is, if it doesn't move into the pore water, it ultimately doesn't move into these organisms. And as the pore water concentration would go down, then the amount that would accumulate, in this case measured by a biota sediment accumulation factor, would also go down. The second illustration of a complex process that might complicate things over just a simple picture of bioturbation being dominant is when we have gas generation released in the sediment. There's always some microbial processes that can lead to gas generation, methanogenesis, for example, deep and anaerobic sediments. And especially when that gas is accumulating and then ultimately released over time from sediments that contain non-aqueous phases or oils, that's a real problem, and we've seen that in a lot of sites, and one that certainly isn't well depicted by that simple picture of bioturbation being dominant. One thing that is shown on this slide 12, though, is that in the absence of non-aqueous phase, it doesn't look like, at least in work that we've done, that gas is as important as other processes. And here I compare it to bioturbation. But 1 centimeter per year for bioturbation might be of order of magnitude compared to much lower than that for typical gas fluxes from gas being generated in sediments. But again, that bets are off. If there's non-aqueous phase, certainly you can have much higher fluxes as a result of the gas moving through that oily phase. A third example of complications are on the next slide, slide 13, where we're looking at mercury methylation. And I'm showing here some data from Benoit et al., where you can see that there are very, very vast changes in biogeochemical conditions in the near-surface environment. Dissolved oxygen might drop off to near zero within millimeters of the surface. And even if we have bulk mercury concentrations, which are relatively high over, in this case, the entire 15, 16 centimeters of sediment, notice the difference in scales there. But if we look at methylmercury, it's confined, or at least it's as a percentage of the total mercury, or even methylmercury itself, it's confined to a fairly shallow layer above the peak total mercury. And methylmercury is what our primary concern is in terms of exposure and risk, uptake into organisms. And oftentimes we see this blooming, if you will, of the methylmercury at levels above where the sulfide might be, which is shown in the final figure on the left-hand side in that same page on 13. And this, again, is just to illustrate that our particular bulk measurement of mercury doesn't tell us where, and it doesn't tell us how much of a risk the mercury is posing, which is much better indicated by the methylmercury. On slide 14 is yet another illustration of complication, and one that's very important relative to the assessment of monitored natural recovery, is the potential of other sources that are not controlled or managed by the remedial activities. In this case, it's actually a capping effort, but one of the things that makes it easy to see in this is that in the Anacostia River, because of the placement of a cap, we have a clean layer, and we can see the redeposition of sediments that
are
contaminated by these sources. And that's what we see on this slide 14 is a higher concentration right at the surface that developed over a period of 18 months after placement of the clean layer. So recontamination by sources is certainly one of the key factors that we need to take into account in monitored natural recovery, as well as any remedial approach. On slide 15, and Victor will come back to this again, but what do we mean by monitored natural recovery? And these are the definitions that are from the contaminated sediment guidance. It's important to recognize that there are a variety of processes that might reduce the exposure and risk associated with contaminants and sediments, and essentially any process that does that will in fact lead to some degree of recovery. That's emphasized still further on slide 16, where there's a hierarchy of natural processes that are identified that might lead to monitored natural recovery, and while it's certainly quite preferred to have transformation and complete elimination of a contaminant to a less toxic form, there are other processes like reduction in bioavailability, reduction of exposure, or even ultimately dilution, which is somewhat implied by number D, can all lead to natural recovery. On slide 17 and also on 18, I've got also two slides drawn from the guidance that just emphasize how you monitor natural recovery in comparison to other remedial approaches, more active approaches such as capping and dredging. And it's important to recognize it is one of these alternatives that should be evaluated, and it should be evaluated in a true and as even a level of comparison as possible with capping and dredging. And on slide 18, my final slide, is a list of some of the elements that are important with respect to each of these approaches, MNR, capping, and dredging excavation, that should be evaluated and compared when you're trying to evaluate remedies. Now, all I've attempted to do is give a short introduction to the topic and to both identify or highlight the importance of recognizing what processes are relevant at a site, but also some of the pitfalls of trying to be essentially trying to apply previous models to any particular site or previous conceptualization to a particular site. You need to recognize that there are processes that are different at all sites, and you need to find out what's relevant at your site, whether it's other sources, whether it is NAPL, or whether it is the conventional view of a fairly stable site with bioturbation being the primary source of exposure and risk. Well, with that, let me turn it over to, well, I guess we'll have some questions, if there are any questions on this short introduction, and then we'll turn it over to Victor to go into much more detail, as well as Leah to go into much more detail for monitoring natural recovery and as well monitoring. So, Kelly, let me turn that back to you for some questions.
Sure. Thanks, Danny. We're going to have just a short Q&A on this part of the presentation. Just going online quickly. In the order of magnitude for bioturbation and ebullition, there are approximately 1 centimeter per year. Are these additive?
The bioturbation, which I show on another slide, a significant fraction, the vast majority of measurements of which I'm aware, at least, range between perhaps 0.01 to 10 centimeter per year. You'd have to look elsewhere on the slide for the exact range. But in any event, it's typically of that order, plus or minus an order of magnitude, so it does vary quite a bit. The gas deposition is based upon a fairly small set of experiments at this point, which is at a much smaller risk. Technically, I believe it would be additive. The processes are largely independent, so they would be additive, although recognize that at least based on this measurement, that the gas ebullition mass transfer rate is very slow compared to bioturbation, and so it really wouldn't be, it's certainly well within the uncertainty of the bioturbation itself.
Okay. Now, is there anyone who has a quick question for Danny over the phone, who's online on the phone for him, before we turn it over to Victor? All right. Well, thank you, Danny, for that great introduction.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to turn it over now to Victor, who's going to cover monitor natural recovery in the bulk of today's talk. Go ahead, Victor.
Thanks, Kelly.
And before we go, Victor, I'd like to remind folks again to please put your mute button on or hit star 6. And also, Victor, feel free to raise your voice a decibel or two for those who have poor audio quality. Thanks.
Sure. And thanks, Danny. That really was great, and it's a really perfect introduction for my talk. And the reason it worked so well is because Danny really did help focus us on all of the processes and the fundamental processes that are occurring in sediments, and these are the processes that are helping us understand how our site is recovering just under natural conditions. Most of what I'm going to talk about is probably more applied in the field. You know, you go out and you take sediment cores, and how might you look at those sediment cores and try and understand the natural recovery processes that are leading to lower concentrations, lower surface sediment concentrations with time. But buried in that understanding and buried in our conceptual site model, we have to have a good understanding of what the mechanistic processes are, understanding that there's bioturbation and gas ebullition, as Danny had mentioned, and just surface sediment mixing, hydrodynamic mixing. There's also burial and natural burial processes. So I will try and hit on those, but I really like that we have this kind of good fundamental understanding, and I think the people on the phone could refer to his slide too, and understanding all the different mixtures of processes that might influence the rate and outcome of natural recovery at a site. So I go to slide 2 as an introduction, and I will talk about, in very high-level terms, I like to start this with understanding the role of natural recovery in our environment and how we've already used it as an industry with, I think, really great success to date. We'll then talk about some MNR definitions and EPA guidance in a little more detail, building on what Danny had talked about. And then we'll go to MNR lines of evidence, and we'll go through a number of different types of lines of evidence that we can use to try and understand the recovery processes that are occurring. And then I'll end with some concluding thoughts of just our remedy decision-making and how we can build MNR into those decisions. Slide 3, advantages and disadvantages. For a lot of us, the advantages are probably self-evident. I mean, many of us think that the advantages are much lower cost, but I think there are other advantages of really taking advantage of ongoing processes, using remedies that build on the natural processes of deposition, of sediment stability, sediment cohesion, and thinking even outside of the box of just natural recovery. As we understand those natural recovery processes, we have an opportunity to even design remedies that are, I would even like to say, more holistic, more in tune with the natural environment, and I think capping often serves that. And then we might be dredging, or we might have to remove areas where it's clear that natural recovery is not working, or that the natural environment is not containing the sediments and there are ongoing exposures or releases, and that might warrant some more aggressive remediation. But I think then what I come to is part of the advantage of natural recovery is just the process of understanding how sediments are behaving in your environment and building a really solid conceptual site model. Disadvantages are that we leave contaminants in place, we have some long-term liability, and we have a long-term monitoring program to address some uncertainty, but I think that can be managed by the long-term monitoring as well to reduce that uncertainty and to improve public perception of this remedy. And then also just the kinetics. I mean, a lot of what Danny talked about was the kinetics at a site. Kinetics, or the rate of these processes, can vary within a site from location to location and can also vary over time. Some of these we may not be able to predict very well, but again, we go to long-term monitoring to try and understand that and try and, again, improve our confidence in this remedy. In slide 4, I bring up a few sites that have used natural recovery. These are 3 pretty well-known sites. The Keystone River and James River, or the Keystone contamination, excuse me, in the James River. Lead at the Interstate Superfund site with introduced natural recovery in its record of decision, and a site where I've worked quite a bit is the PCB site at the Lake Hartwell site in South Carolina. What's sort of interesting about these is all of these had introduced natural recovery in the mid-1990s. I would argue that they had a lot of good science behind them, but not the wealth of evidence that I'm bringing up here and all the lines of evidence that are used to establish natural recovery. For the Lake Hartwell site, for example, there was a 1D HEC 6 model that showed that the site should recover in time, but much of the work that we've done to support natural recovery has been done since the record of decision was established. And despite the success and some of the progress that we've had learning about natural recovery at this site, I think now our burden of proof is going to be changing at our site, and we're having, with the EPA guidance, a larger burden of trying to demonstrate the natural recovery processes beforehand. I think that takes us to slide 5, where we have advances in chemistry. We're able to detect to remarkably low levels. We have a lot of advances that have occurred in the last 10 to 15 years in computer modeling. We also have the benefit of history of time of just having PCBs, other hydrophobic organic compounds regulated, and now being able to look back at sites and seeing how the sites have recovered over the last 10 or 20 years, particularly for those sites that have been prolonged since the mid or late 70s when a lot of these compounds were regulated. And so that is increasing our need to try and establish natural recovery processes, and I think that comes to this talk of trying to understand just what it is we need to bring together, what kind of evidence can we pull together to try and better understand the processes that are happening at our site. We have a lot of general indicators in the environment. I think natural recovery in large part has done an enormous amount in recovering the environment. When we think of source control and forms of wastewater treatment to reduce organic loads into the environment, to reduce nutrient loads in the environment, we have, or even just air pollution of just removing lead from our fuel, that we have air pollution improvement. All of these processes relied on natural recovery and primarily source control. And that takes us to slide 7, where we can see some of the impacts of source control on some of these more persistent contaminants and sediments that we're also concerned with. This came out of the incidence and severity of sediment contamination in surface water in the United States, an EPA document that was updated and re-released in 2004. And it's really work that was done by Ben Meter and his group. And we see general trends in lead since 1975, in PAHs since 1970, in DDT since 1970, since particularly lead and DDT were regulated, that we see general decreases in lakes and waterways in both of those compounds. Perhaps not surprisingly, we see increases in PAHs, and I think all three of these are a really nice reflection of source control, or in the case of PAHs, the lack of source control. Lead, the source control was the removal of lead from fuel and gasoline. DDT was just the regulation of DDT as a pesticide. And PAHs, we see an increase of urbanization, increase of car use, and so we see a subsequent increase of PAHs being released into our waterways. The next slide, slide 8, shows some of the evidence that was used to support these conclusions at a lot of these lakes. And what we see here are vertical sediment profiles. They're dated profiles, so we see them extending from just before 2000 back to about 1940. And we have in the yellow, we have concentrations of each of the contaminants with depth. And the peak concentrations we see corresponding to some of the peak historical use of each of these three respective compounds. Once DDT was regulated, we can see a natural decrease in surface sediment concentrations with time. Once sediment lead was regulated, we can see a natural decrease in lead concentrations with time. PAHs, of course, in this particular case, we see increasing, and this was at the White Rock Lake in Texas. So these are really nice examples, I think, of some of the natural recovery processes we look for, at least with respect to depositional environments, and when we take sediment cores and are trying to look at the history of contaminant release at our site and the impact of source control. When we go ahead to slide 9, of course, we need to remind ourselves that the real endpoint, the receptors, are not surface sediments per se, but fish and ecological receptors, or perhaps, and of course, more importantly, human health and human receptors. This slide in 9 shows PCB concentrations in Great Lakes open water top predator fish. This was taken from an EPA and a Sea Grant publication on the web. And it shows PCB concentrations in particularly Lake Michigan in red and a variety of the Great Lakes. We see decreasing concentrations from the mid-1970s approaching after 2000 to 2002. So this is an optimistic slide in one sense because we see dramatically decreasing concentrations, PCBs, and a similar graph was produced for DDT. But we also see a tailing and a very flat curve from, I would say, about 1992, 94 to 2002. And we see this asymptotic approach of the fish as these curves flatten out with time and as concentrations in the surface sediments decrease, that potentially may approach some kind of asymptotic level. I think if we skip back a slide going back to 8, we can see perhaps some of those asymptotes with the DDT and lead concentrations up at the top of the sediment cores. And this is something that we are concerned with. I don't think we have the benefit of time yet until we wait perhaps another couple decades to see how these sediments continue to respond to source control and hopefully to cleaner surface sediment concentrations with time. And we need to be able to understand the natural recovery processes of how we're approaching cleaner surface sediments, if that is primarily the primary mechanism we're working with for recovery, or if there's a need to accelerate that, whether it's with capping, thin layer capping, or some kind of isolation capping or other methods, which I'll come to more at the very end of the talk. So that takes me to slide 10, and the outline for, I'll talk together about natural recovery definitions and the EPA sediment guidance and how that has changed or perhaps improves our thinking and understanding of what we're looking for natural recovery and what the EPA, I think, is looking for natural recovery processes. Danny already presented the slide 11, and I think really hit on that nicely, that this is really relying on a variety of processes, ongoing aquatic, sedimentary, biological processes to reduce bioavailability and protect receptors. It is, of course, relying on leaving contaminants in place. In the EPA guidance, The definition uses, again, ongoing processes to reduce bioavailability and toxicity of contaminants. In slide 12, there's a number of references to the EPA guidance that I think are worth mentioning. And one of the challenges that we do have with in-place remedies, in-situ remedies, and particularly natural recovery, is gaining regulatory and public confidence in this remedy. It's educating people that there is a recovery process, that's occurring, that we have done our due diligence, if you want to say, to understand what those processes are, and that we have an understanding of the whole system and that this is a reliable process. So we'll start with just kind of hitting on some of these topics. One is that we don't have a presumed remedy. We're not going to presume that capping or dredging work, but nor would we want to presume that M&R work, but we need the body of evidence that can support any of our remedy decisions. We need to implement source control, and Danny reflected on that with the Anacostia cap, that with any remedy, we risk recontaminating the sediment surface, or in the case of M&R, we risk just prolonging the recovery process if we don't have adequate source control. Source control might be the primary source of concern. It could also be secondary sources. It could be a high concentration of contaminants in sediments or in the already released in the environment that continue a release into the sediments and prolong the surface sediment recovery with time. We want to include watershed considerations. We want to include a comparative net risk analysis, so that we have an understanding of all of the stressors in the environment and how our site is behaving in the overall environment. I have one site where we're working on a metals contamination, but there are actually a variety of other contaminants, organic contaminants, that are probably much stronger risk drivers than the metals themselves. And so we need to understand that when we're thinking of a sediment remedy and how that remedy might behave with respect to the other contaminants. We have to include comprehensive monitoring before and after the remedy, and I think the monitoring is going to be an important component of that, of course, of any M&R remedy especially. And we want to establish reasonable timeframes for risk reduction. Timeframes for M&R are always challenging because we're really talking in terms of decades now and not in terms of trying to dredge or cap within just a matter of years. And I think very importantly that M&R can be combined with other remedies and should be combined with other remedies. Any remedy we do, capping, dredging, whatever we're doing, we're still relying at some point on natural recovery. We aren't dredging 100%. At some point we have some concentration cutoff, or we're allowing some level of residuals to occur, and we're relying on the natural processes to help continue the recovery with time. So when we understand that, then we can understand the value of a really solid natural recovery monitoring program that can really help us understand our conceptual site model and understand how best to combine a variety of remedies that would be most suited to the site. For your benefit, listeners, I've put a few quotes here that reflect on this, the idea first of all that there's no presumed remedy, and this is on slide 13. That we want to combine M&R with source control and with other remedies. And just a thought on remedy effectiveness and permanence. And I think EPA does a nice job in their 2005 sediment guidance document of establishing that M&R can be a permanent remedy. We know from our CERCLA evaluation criteria that there's a real strong emphasis on contaminant reduction of toxicity, mobility, and volume, that we can actually leave things in place and still have perhaps that reduction occurs at the sediment surface, or that we can at least establish this as a permanent remedy and it's acceptable to leave in place, I think is very important. And that comes to a quote here that says, deeper contaminated sediment that is not currently bioavailable or bioaccessible and that analyses have shown to be stable to a reasonable degree do not necessarily contribute to site risks. At a site I'm working at, we have contamination that goes down up to 25 feet deep of sediment. It's hard to imagine that much sediment would need to be removed if it is indeed stable. when there's really no remote possibility that that is otherwise bioaccessible or bioavailable. So that brings us to some of the primary lines of evidence that we use, slide 14. Really what we want to try and do is establish low baseline risk conditions. We can't be using MNR to sites that have immediate or acute risks, of course, but I think most of us are probably working on sites with that have existed for a very long time and that there, for which there is not an immediate or acute risk. And by that I mean that, you know, there's immediate death or fatalities occurring, whether aquatic or otherwise. We want to identify trends toward ongoing reduced chemical exposures, reduced risk. And we want to characterize long-term stability to make sure that we have physical stability, geochemical stability, and stability of risk levels. So if we establish low-level and acceptable risk conditions, that we don't have a risk of sediment resuspension and a drastic change in those risk levels, at least a reasonable risk, lack of risk of that to occur. EPA guidance has established, as Danny had mentioned, four criteria. They have sort of a hierarchy of natural processes. This hierarchy really is built on the CERCLA evaluation process in which transformation to a less toxic or less bioavailable form is the preferred approach or preferred process. But it's understood that that does not always happen, at least not immediately, so we also can rely on reduced contaminant mobility and bioavailability that might happen through natural burial like we had looked at in the previous slides. We have reduced exposure at the sediment surface, again, burial. Actually, I should restate that B was more like contaminant mobility through absorption and binding processes. C is reduced exposure through sediment burial, and D is contaminant release, and that would be the example of the Keybone site that I first brought up. That actually was a site where the contaminants in the sediments did not stay in place and release so quickly that they were just through a process of dilution, the Keybone was largely removed from the site. Each of these four processes are going to be having some role in natural recovery at most sites. So although there's sort of a hierarchy of preference, it doesn't necessarily imply a hierarchy of requirements. That is, one site might rely very heavily on sediment and contaminant burial, while another site might rely much more heavily on transformation processes. And I'll try and talk about that as we talk about these lines of evidence. So that takes me to slide 16 and 17 as we start thinking about the various lines of evidence that contribute to, that we can use to support natural recovery. 16 just emphasizes the conceptual site model, and I think Danny covered that really well because that was all of what he was talking about, was really understanding the processes that contribute to contaminant mobility and risk reduction. So I'll go right to 18. And we see A, B, C, and D on the left-hand column that identifies those processes that we just talked about with respect to the EPA hierarchy of goals. But we have contaminant weathering processes. We have contaminant dilution and through natural sedimentation, which I've highlighted and that I'll talk about first. Sediment stability and resuspension. Issues to just make sure that the remedy is stable with time. And we can use modeling. We need to establish that we have ecological recovery. And, of course, we rely on long-term monitoring to support our understanding of the site. And as I've talked about, to verify some of the predicted processes that we're relying on. So we begin with a discussion of just the natural dilution process, processes, natural sediment deposition. And I think the sites that that we had seen before, the Van Meter data, were really good examples of that. And I'll show some more examples. What we rely on in this process is source control. The conceptual model here is that we have, in many of our sites, a net depositional environment where we have a history of sediment deposition that was contaminated. So we have contaminants that are left in place, and then we have ongoing deposition as those contaminant sources were controlled with increasingly clean or less concentrated contaminant concentrations approaching the surface. And with more clean deposition, we anticipate more dilution of that sediment surface. This source control slide on 19 identifies some of the challenges we have with non-point sources, with some of the terrestrial site cleanups might have higher concentrations than what we have in the sediment concentrations. Secondary sources, as I mentioned earlier, also can impact recovery. So very often what we see in sediment cores is, like I said, that kind of asymptotic approach to some background level and not an immediate reduction, but really a slow, gradual reduction of concentrations toward the surface. Slide 20 is a slide that the Navy allowed us to use from the Hunter's Point site, and I think it was a really nice example of characterizing the site and looking at changes of concentration with sediment depth. If we go, 20 gives us the plan view of the core locations. 21 shows a handful of cores with vertical sediment profiles showing reducing concentrations toward the sediment surface. And sediment sites 22, 23, 24 show slices of concentrations at the sediment surface for slide 22. As we go deeper, we see increasing concentrations at the 1 foot depth on slide 23, and then slide 24 at the 2 foot depth, we see some even higher concentrations. So it's, at this point, this site has not selected a remedy. It would not be appropriate for me to say that that natural recovery is an appropriate remedy or a selective remedy for the site, but it does suggest that we do have a lot of reduced concentrations approaching the surface. As we go back to slide 22 and we look at the overall plan area, I think we need to focus on the surface sediment concentrations and exposures that would occur, and we need to also think about sediment stability in this area to understand what is the potential for exposures to some of the higher concentrations compared to what are the exposures at the sediment surface in the biologically active sediment surface layer. We have a very similar story beginning on slide 25 with our Lake Hartwell site. Lake Hartwell, this short course shows sediment age dating, which is a tool that we use to determine the dates of the sediment core profile. We use lead-210 and cesium-137. Both can be used to date sediment cores, so you get, if we look at slide 26, we get dates for each of the sediment core intervals for in these depositional environments. I might step back and just say a lot of what I'm talking about here are what we're looking for and how we might use this information. I think, as Danny mentioned, there's a limited amount of time, so a little bit less time on just how we do these. So, for example, with the sediment age dating, I'll spend a lot less time on describing how to implement age dating rather than how we might view it and how it might help us understand what's happening at the site. And I'll assume that you, the listeners, can find the resources to understand sediment age dating if you don't already have a good handle on that. So our sediment age dating process, it's a very nice tool because it gives us a depositional rate in at the site, usually different depositional rates for different parts of the site. It can tell us how stable the sediment core has been historically, and if we see a lot of disruption or signs of disruption, that might be a sign that there have been big storm events or maybe large depositional events at the site. And we can also relate it eventually to our sediment recovery rates. In slide 26, we see our kind of a classic depositional profile for sediment core that many of us see at PCB sites or other sites with hydrophobic organic chemicals and other persistent chemicals. And as we look at this core vertically from the sediment water interface at the top left down to about 85 centimeters of depth, we see around 85 centimeters. We've cored down to a point in time that preceded much of the release of PCBs in the environment. The peak releases occurred around the late 60s to the late 1970s. Then 1977, PCBs were regulated. And since then, we see this kind of asymptotic approach towards some background level. We didn't really have a lot of modeling fund resources for this, so we used a very simple exercise of just looking at the trends and taking a logarithmic function of that approach toward the sediment surface, trying to get some idea of what the time for recovery would be if we could assume that those trends would continue well into the future. And that's the equation that we see on the slide. In a couple of slides, we'll see the outcome of that. What I show on slide 27 are a number of sediment cores, eight of 18 that we took at the site. And it's quite a busy slide, but I really want to emphasize here just the heterogeneity that we could see at a site and that we saw at the site. We all like to present our nicest data, which we have on slide 26, but I wanted to emphasize, too, that many times we see varying deposits of contaminants with depth, and not everything is always as easily explained, and some of these cores could not be age dated even, so we might not be able to have a rate of recovery for that particular core. But still, I think in general, the trends at the sediment surface were relatively consistent at the site. We saw decreasing concentrations with time at the sediment surface. At the site, as we look in slide 28, at the site, for more or less, we were at about a milligram per kilogram. So we had an estimate to achieve the milligram per kilogram goal of about 1 to 5 years. The time for 0.4 milligrams per kilogram was longer, around 2 to 10 years, depending on the core, and 10 to 30 to get to the much lower level of 0.05 milligrams per kilogram, which may be, really needs some monitoring, because if we are at a longer asymptote, that time may be extended. And when we look at some 95% confidence, some of those levels extend to about 95 or 100 years. So what we really want to establish first and foremost is, do we have acceptable risk levels right now to work with? And if those levels are acceptable, then can we rely on some of the natural recovery processes to continue over these very long periods of decades or even as much as a century? So that brings us to slide 29, natural sedimentation and burial summary, that really what we're relying on is source control. I think it's easy to say source control, but that alone is quite an exercise to understand our primary and secondary sources, to make sure all the sources in a watershed are discontinued, or to what extent might there be background sources that continue to influence background concentrations and this recovery, this natural deposition recovery with time. We have, the coring is a really nice tool because it really does provide a very rapid assessment of the site. In a matter of months or a year, you can get a quick idea of that history of time with sediment depths of how your site is behaving. So it's a very nice tool that tells us how the site is recovering. It also provides opportunities to do things like sediment age dating and to collect a number of other supporting analyses, be it particle size density, TOC, bulk density, ABS, and so on. And it can also be combined, as I mentioned, with geochronology, so we get the age dating. We have an opportunity to look at age dating and to look at benthic mixing using some of the age dating tools. So the next component is contaminant weathering, understanding how weathering might contribute to natural recovery processes. I think for many sites that we work with, as I mentioned, we really do work in these depositional environments. If it were a much more scouring or a river that with much more energy, then we might see so much more release and not have the depositional environment where we have this accumulation of contaminants to contend with. So it's often we find ourselves relying primarily on this depositional process for reductions of concentrations in the surface sediments. But our transformation processes can also lead to a lot of reduced contaminant availability, bioavailability, and even transformations to less toxic concentrations. I have a board here that we can also have some transformations can lead into increased toxicity, and a good example of that, of course, is mercury methylation. So I'll talk about PCB transformation processes, PAH transformation processes, and divalent metal processes and chromium. Beginning with PCBs, and this will be sort of a quick primer on PCBs, but also use some of the Lake Hartwell data to look at how we evaluated PCB weathering in support of natural recovery. And we know that PCBs at low molecular weight, low chlorines, tend to be more mobile. They also tend to be dechlorinated much more difficultly than the higher molecular weight, higher chlorinated PCBs are much more readily dechlorinated. We know PCBs generally dechlorinate at the meta and para positions and not the ortho position. So these can be good clues to us to look at some of the dechlorination processes and the chemical forensics of PCB dechlorination. We also know that the dechlorination is really beneficial insofar as it reduces toxicity. It can reduce the number of coplanar-like PCBs. It can also just reduce the toxicity because lower chlorinated compounds tend to be less toxic than the higher chlorinated compounds. At the Lake Hartwell site, we look at slide 33. We see some of the major patterns that we had seen, that we had observed. We saw a dramatic increase in ortho-saturated or ortho-dominated PCBs. The numbering sequence here, for those of you that are familiar with PCBs, it's the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 numbers, the PCB chlorines around the ring, and 2' through 6' are the numbers for the opposite side of the ring, so it's the biphenyl ring. And the 2s and 6s are the ortho positions. The 3s and 5s are the meta positions, and the para positions are 4. And the reason that is relevant is that the ortho positions do tend to be the most difficult to dechlorinate, but they also impart the least amount of toxicity. So that being a positive feature of the dechlorination process. So what we saw at Lake Hartwell was a very dramatic reduction of tetra through hexachlorobiphenyls, and this accumulation of these 2s and 6s, as you can see here on the slide, with a number of PCBs that represented most of the accumulation of from the dechlorination process. If I go to the next slide, slide 34, on the x-axis we have sediment depths. Now, it's sort of a core lying on its side, if you can imagine, with the sediment-water interface at the zero apex on the left-hand side. And we have the same core that we had seen previously, about 80 centimeters of depth. We also have that core dated on the x-axis in the bottom curve. And we see in the very dark black squares, we see the number of ortho chlorines per biphenyl molecule, which are highly conserved. So we basically have about 2 ortho chlorines per biphenyl on average. And we see over a 30-year period, no removal of those ortho chlorines. Whereas we do see the meta and para chlorines being removed with time, particularly during about the last 25 years or so. And so we were even able to get a dechlorination rate from that, and we had an estimated meta dechlorination rate and an estimated para dechlorination rate. In general, what we saw was about 18 years per chlorine removal. Sounds pretty slow, but basically in about 30 to 45 years, we saw 3 to 4 chlorines removed on average from each biphenyl molecule, leaving the site with mostly monodi and trichlorobiphenyls with sediment depths. And so this one important message with this dechlorination process is that this is a process that is occurring with time and depth. So at the sediment surface, unfortunately, we have really the least amount of dechlorination, most of it is occurring with the buried sediments. Where that becomes relevant, if we look at slide 35, is as we try and understand the toxicity with sediment depth. In this case, we use toxicity equivalencies. We use World Health Organization TE toxicity equivalency factors to calculate dioxin toxicity equivalencies. And we did that for each sediment segment. Again, having this core line at side, we had the bottom left corner is the sediment water interface, and the bottom right corner is that segment at 82.5 centimeters. And the red line, the red curve with the diamonds, you can see those are just the total PCB concentrations. But the bars in that graph on the left-hand side show the toxicity equivalencies, the dioxin of toxicity equivalencies. And we see a more or less flat level of toxicity. That is, toxicity is not reflected in this case by total PCB concentration. And, I mean, the fact that it's flat is perhaps somewhat coincidental. It's more important to note that as we go deeper into the sediment core with much higher PCB, total PCB concentrations, at least using this very simple calculation, we don't appear to increase in total PCB toxicity. So this would be an important reflection on sediment scour or sediment resuspension. If we are concerned, and we generally are, that sediments might scour or resuspend, or there might be a re-exposure of some of those much higher PCB concentrations, it doesn't necessarily infer that we have as comparable exposure in toxicity levels. So the end message for PCBs, and the important messages are, we do get some detoxification, but that detoxification doesn't necessarily happen at the sediment surface because those are the most recently deposited sediments and PCBs. We're really relying that to happen with depth and to provide a long-term detoxification for the site and one that might allow the sediments to stay in place. But in this case, at least for the Lake Hartwell example, we would rely much more immediately on surface sediment dilution and deposition, dilution through the deposition of increasingly clean sediments with time. The next one is pHs, and pHs more or less have the opposite pattern. We have most of the degradation that's going to occur with the lower molecular weight compounds. In this case, we have an oxidative process that occurs and can degrade primarily two-ring, maybe, and three-ring pHs. As we get to four-ring and higher, it gets to be very difficult for bacteria to degrade those pHs. One of the really important considerations for pHs especially, and this is really a message for all compounds, I think we can say, is that the total pHs is not a good indicator of toxicity. That is, we need to really be thinking of pore water concentrations. And I don't really spend a lot of time on this point. There's a lot of new work that's coming out from Stanford's lab and with Dick Luthy, Upal Ghosh, at the University of Maryland, Geschwind, and others that are showing that different materials like coke, pitch, particularly with related to the manufactured gas processes, tend to have such high pH concentrations, but they also have a very low likelihood of releasing those pHs, or that is, that they have very high partitioning of pHs. And so we need to be careful not just to measure total pH concentration, but to understand how much is truly bioavailable. The pitch, for example, can be almost pure pH, but have very low corresponding aqueous concentrations because the KD values, the partitioning coefficients, are so extraordinarily high for those compared to other sediment components like just natural organic matter. This is the Wyckoff Eagle Harbor site that this data comes from as we look at slides 39, 40, and 41. And at this site we were looking at natural processes and the natural degradation of pHs, this being a creosote site which used creosote for wood treatment. And the slide 31 shows a sequence of creosote samples from a pure creosote napple at the top going down with increased weathering, and we see just the loss and a change in the histogram of pHs as we see the loss of lower molecular weight compounds with weathering. Now, when we're looking in the field and we're measuring these, and Danny had reflected on a lot of the mechanistic processes, I just couch this as weathering. You know, we take these field samples and we do a lot of forensics analysis on it, but it's very difficult to separate whether it's dilution and release or whether it's biodegradation of the compounds. I think a lot of it is biodegradation, but a lot of it can also just be the dissolution of lower molecular weight and more mobile compounds like naphthalene. And so what we end up with is just kind of a general weathering pattern that we can see and see how that might be reflected in the surface sediments and what the exposures are, not to just look at total pHs, but to look at the individual components that might impart different types of toxicity, be it naphthalene versus benzoylpyrene, for example. We have a number of, slide 40, we have a number of fingerprinting techniques we can also use, and this is a very simplistic view of just how we can look at pyrogenic versus petrogenic compounds, but the nice story comes in slide 41 when we see how that impacted our understanding of the Wyckoff Eagle Harbor site. And what we had in sediment cores was very close to the site. We had a lot of slightly weathered or even unweathered creosote at sediment depths. A little bit further for the site, we saw this mixture of urban runoff and some more what we called moderately weathered creosote. But out in the middle of the harbor, we have, in the blue and green box, we have primarily urban runoff and natural background signatures. This actually turned out to be a CAP site. We were looking at natural recovery at the natural recovery processes some 5 years ago, but then it was decided that they would still CAP this site. But one of the really important messages or stories that came from this was that not all pHs and not all total pHs were the same. And in fact, that at around the middle of the harbor, we were no longer seeing a creosote signature, but we were seeing primarily an urban runoff signature, and one that seemed to be very much impacted by the ferry terminal that's just north of the core locations, a ferry terminal where we would have cars parked on a regular basis and perhaps the potential for fuel and oil release to the site. So this has influenced the long-term monitoring program, in this case with the sediment cap, that as they look at the sediment cap surface and if they see concentrations of pHs that are higher than anticipated, that there's first and foremost an understanding that we evaluate where those pHs are coming from and what the signatures are, and then try and identify if it is in fact from the original source of the creosote source of the site. So summary on pH weathering. We established that degradation, of course, biases the toward the degradation of lower molecular weight compounds, leaving more persistent higher molecular weight compounds behind. We can see some toxicity reduction from that. We know there's concern in terms of carcinogenic concern of such compounds as benzoylpyrene and the higher molecular weight compounds, but the loss of lower molecular weight compounds can greatly reduce some of the acute toxicity and hazard risks associated with naphthalene and some of the more mobile lower molecular weight pHs. And I think we also established, unlike PCBs, where the weathering of PCBs occurs with time in this kind of progressive dechlorination process, a lot of the weathering we might see with pHs may be occurring at the sediment surface and then really slow down greatly as we get to much more, get to the anaerobic sediments. So much of the pH weathering may be occurring in the aerobic zone where there's bioturbation or where there's some oxygenation to allow for the pH degradation. It's not necessarily absolutely limited to that, to aerobic processes, and there are anaerobic degradation processes, but they tend to be much slower. Well, that covers our organic contaminants, and I think, you know, many of the other organic contaminants, dioxins, DDT, herbicides or pesticides, they'll behave somewhat similarly with respect to thinking about how degradation can contribute to the natural recovery processes. To a large extent, we are still relying on the burial processes or some dilution and concentration reductions at the sediment surface or some bite binding through partitioning and making sure that pore water concentrations are low enough to allow sediments to remain in place. Metals, on the other hand, and this is slide 43, behave much differently, and I think we're all familiar with the potential binding, especially under anaerobic processes, of divalent metals with sulfides, and that allows, that can largely immobilize metals and reduce bioavailability, reduce toxicity. Again, as stated for the pHs, we wanted to state that whole sediment total metal concentration is another very poor indicator of metal toxicity. And as Danny had mentioned, we really need to understand what the pore water concentrations are to understand the real bioavailability of the metals in these compounds. Slide 44, we see a very simple story with metals as we look at whether acid volatile sulfides are greater than simultaneously extracted metals, that is, if the sulfide concentration in the surface sediments or in the sediment bed are greater than the metals concentration, then most of those or all of the metals are going to be bound anaerobically as metal sulfide precipitates. Whereas if acid volatile sulfides are less than metals, then while maybe not all of the metals are bound, perhaps they are because there may be other components, other species that are actually binding those metals. And the reason this becomes very important for metals is metals actually can end up with very much higher concentrations at the sediment surface. Unlike the model that we just explained for some of the organic contaminants, we might be just relying primarily, if not solely, on metals binding with acid volatile sulfides and other binding constituents that can immobilize metals, reduce bioavailability, and thus reduce and any concern for toxicity. A note for then in the case where these metals are higher than the ABS concentrations as we go to slide 45, we need to then have a better understanding. We don't want to just assume that the metals are toxic. We want to actually go out and understand or evaluate them more, maybe through pore water concentration measurements or some additional modeling to just understand what the real potential for toxicity is. And I think the best place, the best source for all of us to go to for this is EPA's 2005 procedures for the derivation of equilibrium partitioning sediment benchmarks for protection of benthic organisms. And I have a reference there for you. Chromium is not a divalent metal, but behaves similarly. Chromium is unique in that it too will reduce, in this case, from chrome 6 to chrome 3 under reducing anaerobic conditions. In the case of chromium, sulfides can be a very good indicator of toxicity, of reducing conditions. Sulfides may and as well as organic carbon and iron. And so we use ABS as a metric to determine whether or not chromium should be reducing. But generally what we're looking at is an electron donor, electron acceptor relationship that allows chromium to spontaneously transform to chrome 3 under anaerobic conditions. So, and this becomes important as in a compound dear to my heart as I am working on a chromium site, that to understand what the relative or what the potential for bioavailability of chromium is under reducing sediment conditions. The real concern for chromium, as I think we're all aware of from our Aaron Brockovich movie of chrome, of chromium is chrome 6. And the real hazard that we all have with chromium is an inhalation hazard with, as chrome 6 is inhaled, that can be very toxic. Chrome 6 is very soluble, so if we do see chrome 6 in sediments, we might infer that we have a groundwater source or some way of chromium mobilizing through the environment. But once it does Chrome 3, it's going to precipitate out and be really immobile in the environment, and much less toxic, if largely non-toxic. So Chrome 6, Chrome 3 chemistry, divalent metal chemistry with, under reducing conditions, understanding these processes can really help understand for metals, especially how the transformation processes can reduce or even eliminate contaminant mobility and toxicity. I think the exception to that, of course, is mercury, and that is much more challenging. And I think, especially with the figures that Danny had shown, because mercury can methylate, and we're at slide 47, the methylation process under anaerobic conditions, although mercury also can form a metal sulfide precipitate, in this case mercury sulfide, and reduce the mobility of mercury through that precipitation process, the methylation process can increase the mobility. So we have a very different challenge, and now one that might rely on reduced concentrations or burial or other processes that might have to contribute, not just the reduction of metals as precipitate. Slide 48. Just a summary for metals. MNR for divalent metals, as I mentioned, relies primarily on reduction in precipitation to non-toxic metal sulfide precipitates. The MNR for chromium relies on an anaerobic reduction to immobilize and chromium to its non-toxic form as chrome 3. ABS-SEM is used to screen toxicity and can be a good screening measure. But if there are concentrations of SEM that are higher than ABS, we need to continue to go out and do more investigation. We don't want to just presume that the metals are mobile. Cold water measurements, thus, are used to measure bioavailability directly and probably the most valuable tool for that. Burial can also contribute to natural recovery for metals. And of course, just like any other compound, we might rely in part on burial, but also on these geochemical processes. So the next subject is sediment stability, sediment suspension. Once we've established natural recovery processes, and we're relying, be it, especially if we're relying on sediment burial, we need to have a good understanding of our, of the sediment stability. And this really falls in the CERCLA requirements for long-term remedy, long-term effectiveness. So we think of long-term effectiveness, we want to think of long-term risk reduction, prolonging or increasing additional risk reduction that might happen over time with additional burial or some of these chemical processes. But also, we want to make sure that we aren't going to resuspend or rescour some of the sediments and potentially release them and increase exposures with time. So the sediment stability, and I would also say we want to make sure we have geochemical stability, that the contaminants aren't otherwise released in the environment. We have a couple comments or quotes from the EPA guidance on slide 50. The guidance says, and I think it's important to recognize that sediments need but not be stable per se. That is to say, it's not just sediment stability, but it's also the potential for contaminant release if there is a scour event. If, for example, you have a metal precipitate that's stable once that's a metal precipitate, even under aerobic conditions, you might allow for some exposure or some sediment resuspension. On the other hand, you know, generally speaking, it's less desirable, and it's something that we would like to be able to say that we have a stable sediment bed that we can rely on and leave these contaminated sediments in place. So focus should always be on risk, not just on stability per se. But that said, I think we want to think of how to, I want to talk a little bit about how we measure stability and how we might think of it and evaluate it for our sites. Slide 51 comes back to this Lake Hartwell sediment core. And what we're thinking of now is we're thinking of leaving these sediments in place. And we look at the sediment depths, and if we had a scour event that were to scour, let's say, 30, 25, 30 centimeters, we could have some exposure of much higher concentrations than what's at the sediment bed surface to date. And so that's really what drives our concern. We have concentrations that are approaching some goal, in this case the vertical green line being the 1 milligram per kilogram concentration goal, and we want to know that that's going to continue into the future. So when we look at stability, we can generally use two tiers of evaluation. The first being just a paper evaluation of trying to understand, using some default parameters, what the potential for stability is. But that might be, that generally is pretty conservative. The tier two evaluation would be to actually measure and calculate sediment shear strength, to measure hydrodynamic flow velocities, and get an estimate of what the sediment scour would be under a normal or high energy, say 100-year event. We might be able to complement that with a mass balance approach, trying to understand the mass of sediments going in, the mass of sediments going out. We can complement that with understanding sediment geochronology using sediment age dating, sediment cores, and the vertical concentration profiles to see if there have been disruptive events historically. And all of that can really help build up an understanding of the sediment bed and the stability of the sediment environment. Slide 53. So as we measure sediment stability, we want to measure sediment shear strength, and we want to measure the hydrodynamic processes. The hydrodynamic processes are the forces that are having the potential to scour the sediments, and the sediment shear strength, that's what's holding the sediments in place. Generally, for sediments, for cohesive, well-consolidated sediments, the stuff we often find ourselves working with, the black mayonnaise-like sediment or the very clay-rich, organic-rich sediment, we don't have any models that can tell us how that we can apply to calculate sediment shear strength. We actually need to measure it empirically, use in the field or ex situ, using sediment cores. Unlike, for example, a simple model for just sand movement or sand resuspension and non-cohesive materials, for those that we do have models that can apply to that and mathematical models that can calculate the resuspension potential. So we need to use some site-specific measurements, and then we also need to be able to measure hydrodynamically what the velocities are, just both at normal events and during 100-year storm events, or including waves, or including the potential for navigation prop wash if that's a concern. I would say, I mean, these become pretty complicated analyses. A lot of this is very state-of-the-art work that is evolving and that we're all learning it about as an industry, trying to evaluate sediment stability, and that's really come to the surface and been published even in just the last 5 years. So a couple of the slides that I'll show you are work that really has been done very recently in trying to understand or estimate the potential for sediment scour at a site that I'm working at. So the next slide gives an example of 100-year storm surge velocities at the site. So this is work that we're doing with Limnotech, and they help do the analysis of hydrodynamic velocities. This is on slide 54, and you flip to slide 55, and you'll see pretty much the same slide, but in this case, we're looking at hydrodynamic shear forces at the bottom of the sediment at this 100-year storm event. We had a dark red spot, and that really reflects the navigation channel that we have at the site where most of the flow flows right through along this navigation channel. But as we get to the shoreline on either side, we also have some shear forces that we need to address, and we need to understand what the potential might be for sediment resuspension. And then in some of the backwater areas, like the really dark blue areas, we have very, very low scour potential, almost virtually no scour potential at all. And so those are some of the very stable depositional areas that we have at the site where we can leave sediments in place. Now, in parallel with that, we also collected sediment cores and ran a sed plume analysis to get a direct measurement of sediment shear strength. And that's shown in slide 56. This was given to me by Sea Engineering, who did this analysis for us. And the sed plume provides an opportunity to, if you can see on the plume at the top, in the left-hand side of the drawing, we have a flow of water that passes over the top of the sediment core, and then that sediment core is pushed up into the plume incrementally so that we can measure the amount of energy, the amount of water or hydraulic energy that is required to scour the sediment surface as it's moved up into the plume. So the water increases incrementally from a very low flow rate to a high flow rate until we see some sediment scour, and then we push the plume up again, or the sediment core up into the plume, and we go through the same process, and we can get a profile of sediment shear strength with depth. I hope I did justice to that in that explanation. But I also would encourage anyone to talk to email me if you have more questions on how this works, or we can also talk to Craig Jones, who does a lot of this work at Sea Engineering. Now, that's a process I'd like to work with, and I've worked with a lot, is the sed plume, but there's a number of different plume designs and plume processes that different people have used. There are in-situ plumes that could measure direct in-situ sediment shear strength, basically all following the same process. If you can have a measurable amount of water flow over the sediment surface, and you can measure the amount of scour that occurs, you can then infer through calculation what the amount of energy was imparted and how much energy it required to scour the sediment. And so you can determine what the sediment shear strength is. And the ultimate goal is to try and piece that together with our hydrodynamic measurements so we can get an estimate of what the scour potential is at our site. And this particular location on slide 57, we show where we combined the hydrodynamic model results for a 100-year storm event over a 24-hour period with the sediment shear strength sediment shear that would occur over that period with wind wave energy that would also be imparted, and we get a net sediment bed shear that's imparted onto the sediment bed surface, and with that, and at the peak time of the storm, we have some sediment erosion that occurs from this model. This is just a 1D vertical model that we applied at each sediment core location. In this case, what we saw was about a 3-centimeter scour that occurred at the 100-year storm event. But we also saw some recovery because we also had some redeposition of this material with time at the same location. So we had a little bit of rebound. There are a number of things that go into these calculations. There's a lot of self-armoring as we start to scour the sediment surface. There's armoring that occurs because you're removing some of the lighter particles first, and then the sandier particles stay behind, so you can get some self-armoring and have perhaps much less scour than you would just assume if you just looked at the sediment core profile and sediment shear strength or critical shear strength with sediment depth. This does require some kind of modeling analysis to be able to incorporate all of the different mechanistic processes that are occurring at the sediment bed surface. But I think it's a really nice example of how we might evaluate sediment shear strength. And in this case, 3 centimeters of the 100-year storm really provides or results in very little concern for sediment scour at this particular location. But that should not reflect a bias that all sediment sites or all locations will just end up with just 3 centimeters, and there may be much higher scour in different environments. So, slide 58, what we want to try and understand is what is the potential for sediment scour. If there is a scour event, does that increase risk exposure or exposure of higher, perhaps unacceptable surface sediment concentrations? And then what are appropriate responses to sediment scour? I mean, is an appropriate response that, well, it's going to scour, then we need to remove the sediment? I mean, maybe in some areas, or could it rely on long-term monitoring? For a case like this, with just 3 centimeters of scour, I think we would rely on long-term monitoring and see, after some major storm event, go back and see how that has impacted the sediment bed surface. Or can we use various preventative measures like capping, armoring, something to help stabilize the sediment, so not even the 3 centimeters of scour occur. I have a question, when is dredging an appropriate preventative measure? And that's obviously, I mean, perhaps you can hear from my bias, that dredging should be used judiciously, and one that maybe, if the sediment scour is ongoing or has the potential to continually re-release contaminants into the environment, then it may warrant some removal. But if the bed is generally stable and we can use in-situ remedy, I think that allows us to understand these natural recovery processes and use them to facilitate site remediation. The next part of our next number, line of evidence is modeling. And I will talk just very briefly on modeling. I'm not a modeling expert, and I think those of you that are interested probably need to talk to a modeling expert. But I just wanted to have some general themes about how we might use modeling to better understand our site. I mentioned conceptual site models and the importance of those. We have one-dimensional vertical models like the one I just showed, I think can be very valuable and much, faster. That was done in a matter of weeks rather than thinking of a very large-scale sediment transport model that might be much more complicated. We do have sediment transport modeling that can help serve our interest in our understanding of the site, contaminant bait and transport modeling, and biological modeling that can, all these different model components can come together to understand our site and to understand the natural recovery processes. I like to think of modeling, as I think we all are learning to do, as a tool, not an endpoint of our process, and as a tool to understand or maybe predict what we're happening, what will be happening in the future. Perhaps the endpoint would be the long-term monitoring for a natural recovery site. You have a model prediction of where the site is going to go with time. You use monitoring to validate that model with time, be it monitoring for, a few years, 5 years, and go through a 5-year review, or even for decades. Slide 61 is a slide that Tim Decker let me use from Limnotech, and it gives a nice view of the increasing complexity that we encounter with models. We can start with some pretty simple hydrodynamic models, understanding just a simple statistical model to get basic information about flow conditions and maximum flows at the site, and looking at historical records or historical gauge stations to try and understand basic principles of hydrodynamics at a site. We can go into a detailed numerical model for hydrodynamics, and to better predict flow direction, magnitude under unique site-specific conditions, under 100-year storm conditions, and establish various links between various boundary conditions, be it dams or other inputs to the system. We can also begin to integrate particle transport into that hydrodynamic model to understand how particles are moving. And a very simple particle transport model might be the first deposition, the first movement of that particle with distance. Resuspension of particles gets more complicated, and we start to need a more of a mechanistic sediment transport model to be able to understand sediment deposition and resuspension and movement and accumulation. And then ultimately we can bring that to a contaminant bait and transport model where we look at not only sediment resuspension and deposition, but partitioning processes and other contaminant bait processes. So the important thing is we shouldn't be thinking that we need to go right into the to step 5, but that each of these different scales of effort can help us better understand the site, and this can be a gradual and even progressive process of modeling. But some would say, and I would say, that any conceptual model, anytime we think about the site and have some way that we're describing the site, we're using a model, be it on paper, of just describing how the site behaves from the conceptual site model to a mathematical model. We need to use some kind of a model to understand the behavior of the sediments. So I have a couple examples of, in 62, 63, and 64, these were provided to me by Craig Jones. These are really simple 1D models that I think provide a really nice tool for understanding behavior of sediment behavior at a site. And the reason I like these, you know, you can do a multiple 1D models like the one we saw for the sediment scour set plume process a few slides ago. But this allows us to get an idea of maybe how the behavior looks in different areas. And you can do this 1D model at any core location or any location at the site that has the supporting data to understand these behaviors. The first one shows, the first case is just no deposition at the site and really just shows a surface sediment mixing process through benthic mixing, diffusion processes for, and in all of these cases we're looking at PCBs in the surface sediment profile. And we see kind of we see that 1.5 years, which really would reflect time zero, shifting over to the left, particularly at the top of the sediment core, we see dilution occurring and the bioturbation processes over time, over 100 years, resulting in some surface sediment concentration reduction. When we add a deposition component to that, we see that the deposition component can really dominate that process. And we see the apex of the curve, the peak on the right-hand side, shift downward with time with sediment deposition. In this case, we have a 0.5 centimeter per year mixing process. Now, a lot of this is showing concentrations going down with time and over the 100-year period down to non-detectable concentrations. And I think we recognize that we may have prolonged processes and longer asymptotes with some of these processes that may occur that may limit the rate of recovery with time. And the case three is an example of deposition with much higher, much heavier mixing at the sediment surface, benthic mixing and hydrodynamic mixing that ends up reducing that immediate rate of recovery and kind of spreads the PCBs vertically much more than the deposition only and low level mixing process. But these are by no means absolute, and the real emphasis here is just on how we might be able to use models to understand our site, understand recovery with time, and even use that then to predict our monitoring approach. And we might, these models, if we have some idea of how the surface sediments will behave with time, then we can use that to monitor and better understand the recovery of the site as we move forward. Number six.
Yeah? This is Leah. A little time check. We might need to move a little faster here.
Okay. Oh, my. Okay. I will. Thank you. On ecological recovery, the important message is that, of course, at the end of this, all of this talks about sediment concentrations, and we really need to be thinking also about ecological recovery. So I'm going to kind of pass that off for the next session, because I think we're going to talk about long-term recovery monitoring, and I think Leah and I can talk about the ecological recovery components together and how we might use monitoring of fish or monitoring of endpoint of receptors to look at natural recovery too. One important thing just being that those responses tend to be much slower than some of the sediment responses, so it may take a lot more time for the ecological recovery to respond to the levels that were to our concentration goals in fish or other higher level receptors. I think with that, and because I'm leaving us with about a half hour for the long-term monitoring talk, what I'd like to just reflect on at the very end of this is, as we think of how we're using MNR, I already talked about trying to use MNR that really complements or built in with other remedies and remedy considerations. I think that dredging, sediment capping, MNR should all be very complementary to one another. But the MNR program, if we look at slide 71 and 72, we try and get a remedy for successful site assessment. We need this kind of rigorous site evaluation to understand all of these natural processes. It may or may not end up resulting in a natural recovery selected remedy. We also need to think of costs and how costs are going to influence our recovery, and at some sites it may behoove us then to add, say, a thin layer cap or to add a sediment cap to help stabilize the sediment, to build confidence in the remedy, and still build on the natural recovery processes that we've established and use the natural recovery to even to build confidence in the sediment capping remedies or other remedies. So I think that natural recovery processes in Slide 72, they're always ongoing. We need to maximize MNR to reduce some of the negative impacts that we might have from other remedies, and make sure that those remedies, as I say, complement MNR, integrate MNR with those remedies, and then use monitoring to reduce uncertainty. So I think we could probably transition to the monitoring. I may have just taken up all my time for questions, but I would definitely welcome questions offline as well for, and I'm sorry that it took longer than expected.
Thanks, Victor. We're a little over schedule, but that's okay. This is, again, your talk was the bulk of the talk. Does anybody over the phone have a quick question for Victor? We'll open it up for a few minutes.
Yeah, what is sediment bed load and how is it measured?
Sediment bed load is kind of the crawling of sediments, if you want to say, that are moving along the sediment bottom. They usually tend to be heavier sediment particles, sandier particles, that might occur during with enough energy to move that. They're not, they need to be distinguished perhaps with or from suspended sediments. If you can think of clay particles that are floating and moving within the sediment column almost freely and are much more buoyant, the sandy particles don't really lift up or float as much into the sediment column. They tend to crawl along the bottom, creating what is a bed load. And that can have a varying level of density that that can then move contamination, potentially, or it can move clean sediment on along the sediment bed surface. It can be measured using bed load samplers. They're much like sediment traps. If you think of a sediment trap of a kind of laid on its side, and it's designed to reduce the amount of resuspension or removal and just to accumulate bed load as it moves along the sediment bottom. And that would be the nature of a bed load sampler.
Victor, just a question. My name is Ron Leach from EPA in Region 9. Have you ever had experience with VOCs like trichloroethylene in sediments, say at like 150 parts per million levels?
Well, indirectly, I mean, I know that there's a lot of work that, for example, Bart Chadwick has done at the Navy Spaywell Labs on chloroethanes, and he's tracked chloroethane plumes that have come up in sediments. I mean, I would think that less a sediment problem, more a groundwater problem, not really understanding your site by any means, but when I think of chlorinated solvents that are really only going to be in place or in the sediment bed if they're moving through the sediment bed, but otherwise would be not stable enough to really adhere or create a long-term sediment problem, then the source control can add to natural recovery by controlling that source on a groundwater or land side, and then as opposed to thinking of it as a sediment-related problem. But
all right, well, thanks, Victor. I think we're going to conclude the Q&A session now since we are a little bit behind. For those who submitted questions online, et cetera, we'll be following up with the presenters, and also, as Victor had mentioned, we have his email on their hot link that you can feel free to follow up with him after today's seminar. With that said, then, we're going to kick off the monitoring section of this with Leah Evanson with EPA. And Victor will also be presenting part of this. I think what we'll try to do is present this section in about roughly 20 minutes, have a short Q&A, and then conclude today's seminar on time at about 4:15. So with that, Leah, could you kick it off?
Sounds good. Thanks a lot. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move right to slide 3, skipping over the outline. I want to talk for a minute about why we want to monitor. And the main reason here is that sediment sites or any site needs to be monitored so that we can manage the uncertainty that we all face when we conduct any environmental cleanup. And this slide lists a bunch of sources of uncertainty. Let me just mention a couple of them. First, in the physical and chemical area, our characterization of a site is based on sampling, and we can't sample everywhere. We can't sample continuously, although sometimes EPA has been accused of remediation through unending sampling. But especially in the aquatic environment, there's always uncertainty about our characterization. And then there are also major uncertainties about contaminant contributions from outside the site, especially other sources that might not be controlled as well as we'd like. And in the biological area, that introduces additional uncertainties, such as the relationship between the chemical concentrations in the sediment in specific parts of the site and possibly a wider biological effect at higher trophic levels. If you move to slide 4, this lists some of the types of monitoring which we should be undertaking at most sediment sites. And sometimes it's helpful to think about monitoring in the three phases that are shown here. First, construction or performance monitoring that usually only applies to active remedies like capping or sediment removal, although it could also apply to enhanced natural recovery scenarios. Things that involve thin layer capping. This type of monitoring includes monitoring contaminant releases from remedy implementation also during capping and dredging. Short-term monitoring then is a mix of both short-term performance monitoring and monitoring for risk reduction, where that's measurable in the short term, such as when contaminants are not bioaccumulative. And then long-term monitoring that's focused on long-term performance monitoring and long-term risk reduction. I'd like to make a point about long-term monitoring that it's not just applicable to in-situ remedies like capping and M&R. People often believe that they aren't going to have to do long-term monitoring at dredging sites, but we're finding that that's not usually the case, especially for sites where are trying to dredge bioaccumulative contaminants. We find that where cleanup levels at dredging sites are very low, we usually need to rely on a combination of backfill plus long-term natural recovery to achieve the risk reduction that we're hoping for. And so even though significant mass may have been removed by the dredging remedy, usually the sediment surface is only slightly cleaner than it was prior to dredging. So that means that biota recovery is going to be quite slow, and that even at these dredging sites, it's often necessary to do long-term monitoring. So if you skip over slide 5 and go to slide 6, deciding what needs monitoring has a lot to do with the way in which the remedy is supposed to be achieving its goals, and some of these are listed in the slide here. We'll talk about this briefly. For M&R, as we saw in Danny and Victor's presentation, there's a wide variety of mechanisms that are contributing to risk reduction. Some of these are faster and some slower, but usually the fastest, as Victor mentions, is natural sedimentation and the dilution and the burial that it provides. So that's usually the main focus of most M&R monitoring. And for capping, then the risk reduction is primarily through burial and isolation of the contaminated sediment. So we're generally monitoring for that in the short term. And in the long term, we may also be monitoring through cores for contaminants moving up into the lower layers of the cap, where our models are showing us that the contamination is likely to be sequestered for long periods. So moving to dredging is often intended to reduce current risk, such as sediment toxicity or contaminant concentrations in fish, but in fact, it's most effective at reducing buried contaminant mass, which might cause a future risk. Since reducing current risk depends on whether we can effectively reduce the surface concentration in the biologically active zone, with dredging, we usually achieve that through natural recovery or backfill. And slide 7 just gives us kind of a graphic overview of material that I think has been previously covered. Let me just mention the red lines that are off to the right of each of these scenarios show what the contaminant profile often looks like in each case. So you can spend some time after the talk taking a look here at the profiles that for capping and natural recovery show the bulk of contamination remaining in place and the sediment surface being lowered through the clean cap or natural sedimentation. Moving to slide 8, this lists some examples of common monitoring goals for the three types of remedies. For M&R, we're usually focused on validating our understanding of the ongoing natural processes. To do that, it's important to understand the expected rate of those processes, and Danny touched on that in some of his talk. Let me give an example here. If the monitoring shows, or if modeling of our site shows that we're unlikely to be able to see a measurable change in some factor for a number of years, say 3 years, then we need to factor that into the monitoring plan so that we spend our money in looking for that change when we actually expect it to happen in 3 years. Much of the performance monitoring for M&R is focused on sediment stability. Going back to Victor's presentation, if the core testing showed that the level of shear stresses that are likely to move sediment are associated with a certain level flow event, you might want to use that level of flow event to trigger monitoring. For capping, the performance monitoring is usually focused on validating cap placement, looking to see if repairs are needed after large hydrodynamic events, and then periodically looking for surface contamination and, in the long term, contaminant migration into the cap from below. And for dredging, the performance monitoring includes validating that you removed the sediment you intended to, looking to see how much residual is left behind, and then validating any backfill or natural sedimentation that you're using as part of the remedy. And for all three of these scenarios, monitoring ecological recovery is almost always also necessary to demonstrate actual risk reduction. And that's either monitoring the benthic recovery from a toxic condition or monitoring higher trophic level receptors like fish. So moving on, and I think I will skip over slides 10 through 12, except to just say that the bottom line in developing a monitoring plan is that it's don't collect data that you aren't going to use to make a decision, and do collect the data that you actually need to decide what needs to be done. This is basically the DQO process to figure out what questions you need monitoring to answer, decide what's the best way to actually assess that, and make sure that you determine that the methods are going to be statistically valid, and figure out what's cost effective and carry it out. Let's move briefly to monitoring tools, and these are listed in slides 14 and 15 and 16. And I think I won't go over these here, except I would like Victor maybe to mention just for a minute about how we sample pore water, because as he mentioned, we're becoming more aware in recent years of the importance of monitoring pore water chemistry, especially for the hydrophobic contaminants that we're finding is a much better indicator of risk than the bulk sediment chemistry that we're used to measuring. Do you want to just spend a half a minute on that, Victor?
Yeah, thank you. So we have, for the pore water sampling on 15, we have direct pore water sampling, which we can use something like the Navy's Trident probe. This is something, again, that the SPAWAR group, Bart Chadwick, has been promoting. They've created a probe that has an outer casing of a sand pack that allows you to bore right into the sediment surface, and the sand pack keeps the probe from clogging and allows for collection of some pore water samples. And it's still somewhat experimental, but being proven really nicely, so I think it's closer, if not already, ready for prime time. Passive samplers, peepers, are plastic containers. They can be like Nalgene containers or some absorbent-resistant container that then cuts off around the top of those peepers and puts a mesh that would allow diffusion through that mesh in the sample bottle. You'd fill the sample bottle with DI water, place it into the sediment surface, and through diffusion, you would allow some equilibrium to occur with time, and those might be deployed for several weeks at a time, and then you would collect those pore water samples, bring them to a lab, and analyze the constituents in the in what used to be DI water and now is very much closer to what's at the site. And then there's hydrophobic samplers, SPMDs, SPMEs, and those rely on absorption of hydrophobic contaminants onto the surface or into the samplers themselves. Those are also fairly state-of-the-art, but have been seeing a lot of application in the last 5 years, and I think everyone can find a number of resources of literature on these different types of samplers. Seepage meters are are used. These are the seepage meters, also something that was developed by the Navy, but would be an inverted drum, if you might say, or inverted container that would allow for the flux of the groundwater, and this would be for an upwelling site where groundwater is passing through the sediment or where there's enough of a flux of pore water into the water column, and then the seepage meter would be placed on top of the sediment surface to collect that sample. So these are numbers.
EPAORD has done a lot of work in that area too recently.
Just exactly. Thanks. So there's just a number of samples. There's a lot of energy in trying to find a really easy way because sediment sampling or pore water sampling is so challenging. We're seeing a lot of these experimental approaches now that are really being evolved into nice tools that we can use to measure pore water in the environment.
Victor, do you want to maybe spend our last 5 minutes on the case study? Because I think it's quite interesting.
Sure. I think what's probably most interesting about this, and I'm going to skip over to, slide 18, just to give you a sense of where the site is in Eagle Harbor. This is a capped site, and the blue outline, red outline, and green outline are three different capping events that occurred over a 10-year period. And we go to the next slide. What I like about this is reflecting what Lee had talked about, was thinking about what are we sampling, why are we sampling it, and that there is real value in all of the different metrics of what we're going out to sample, not just sampling for the sake of sampling itself. So the questions that were being asked by the site, and this is a site being led by EPA and Army Corps of Engineers, is actually had implemented the remedy and is doing the monitoring for EPA in Region 10, is the cap physically stable? That is it remaining in place? And they use bathymetry to evaluate primarily bathymetry, objective one, which is on slide 19. Is the cap effectively isolating the underlying contaminated sediments? And you can do some surface sediment sampling. I commented on that already, reflecting on whether the contaminants are, the pHs are creosote related versus urban runoff related, but still surface sediment sampling primarily if they need to and if they see some kind of exceedance above the Washington State standards for surface sediments and pHs. Then they might do additional sampling. If they still see a problem and a persistent problem at a location, they might actually then take some sediment cores to see if there's a pathway through the sediment cap. But and then they want to say, see, are the sediments in the biologically active zone remaining clean relative to the Washington State sediment standards? so that, again, it's from using surface sediment sampling to achieve those goals. They, slide 20 shows a number of the tools that they use and how they're actually implementing that sampling program. 21 through 25 show bathymetric measurements. They show the bathymetric transects that were used at different events, and then they use the differences, which culminate in slide 25, into the amount of sediment depth that was placed with the sediment cap. We have increasingly refined bathymetric tools with multi-beam surveys that can really help get an even more detailed sediment survey. But the end result here was that they saw a very nice, stable sediment cap. They have a good understanding of what the depths are at the site and how the cap was distributed. So they have a very nice story for the site in terms of physical stability of this cap in this pretty nice, contained, relatively quiescent inner harbor area of the Eagle Harbor area. The one area that has shown scour was where the ferry terminals were located. And so there was a decision that was made that they would not recap underneath the ferries because of all the energy that those ferries impart. It would be just a never-ending battle to fight the ferries and trying to keep that sediment from resuspending in that particular pathway of the ferries going from Bainbridge Island to Seattle. But with that exception, the cap is really very stable. And then they did slide 26 show subtidal surface sampling locations. They have a grid that they established, and they have some statistical randomness of where they're going to collect their samples, so that they're not actually doing a complete characterization of the site, but rather trying to use some statistics and really reduce the numbers of samples that they have to collect for this site. And I think that has also worked very effectively for them. Slide 27 shows where they've taken some through sediment cores, and we're also doing some sediment coring at the site and seeing a very intact cap that is showing very little potential for contaminant migration through the sediment cap. And then we have some intertidal areas. So they've basically broken this out into different areas of importance, the intertidal areas being one of the most important areas biologically for the site, and they created a beach for the intertidal zone, and that's seen in slide 28 where they've taken some sediment samples and kind of just gives a quick overview of how they're implementing this remedy, this long-term monitoring plan. And then parallel to that, we go to slides 29, 30, 31. NOAA had implemented a long-term monitoring plan for English soles. Now, this was not actually part of the EPA's and Army Corps of Engineers' long-term monitoring plan, but was a separate study that was conducted by NOAA. And what they show when we see slide 31 was a really dramatic reduction in fish liver lesions in English sole, beginning at time zero, which was mid-80s, to about 8 years after the cap was implemented. So that's a nice story of the biology that did not actually get integrated into the cap remedy long-term monitoring, but really tells a nice story of how the site has responded ecologically to and recovered from the pH contamination. I think that is, except for the conclusions, would say much of what I said. I think that covers that very quickly, I hope, for the long-term monitoring as a case study for that site. Did I miss anything, Leah?
No, sounds good. Maybe we should just point out the summary slides that are here for MNR capping and dredging and spend the remaining time on questions.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Leigh and Victor, for going over that monitoring section for us. I'll quick question on the monitoring was where can I find additional information regarding the flow water samplers? This is from Michael Neal in Louisiana. Victor or
I would encourage them to send emails to each of us, and we can pull some resources together. I would probably be giving you contacts in our Office of Research and Development.
Okay. And for those folks who are doing it in AutoStream as well, is that many of your questions that have been submitted, we'll make sure that they get to the presenter and are answered that way. Is there any questions over the phone regarding monitoring? Anyone have any feedback on the monitoring side of things? We have a lingering question for Victor with regards to the M&R, since we're about 5 minutes before we're going to close this session on the M&R part. All right.
Do you want to pull some of their questions off the web, Kelly?
We can do that. I think what we'll do, though, is those that are online, we'll submit those via email to the actual presenters, and we'll come to then, since we're coming to a close here in a couple
okay.
of minutes. All right. Well, I want to thank Danny, Victor, and Leah for presenting the material for today. I also want to thank again the participants for being part of this particular webcast, as well as the past if you did join us for the dredging and capping over the last couple of weeks. As a final note, again, we do plan on archiving all these sessions with the soundtrack, so those of you can review the material again with the sound, with the instructors actually talking as they have today, or pass them along to your colleagues. I hope you've enjoyed today as well as the previous webcasts. And again, please give us comments on these webcasts, because we do look at them and then we revise accordingly. With that said, I hope everybody has a good afternoon. Thank you.